You're listening to The Globalist, first broadcast on the 22nd of November 2021 on Monocle 24. The Globalist, in association with UBS. Hello, this is The Globalist, coming to you live from Midori House in London. I'm Georgina Godwin. On the show ahead, there's still uncertainty about the safety of Chinese tennis player Peng Shui. We'll ask if this case could derail Beijing's push for sporting soft power. Then...
it's just hard to accept the verdict as it was put across. I'd love to tell you that I was surprised, but that's just not the truth. I'm disappointed. But I wasn't surprised.
In a trial that's divided America, Kyle Rittenhouse has been found not guilty of murder of anti-racism protesters. We'll speak to an alderman for the district of Kenosha. Prime Minister Modi has backtracked on controversial agricultural legislation. We'll ask how this informs the political landscape in India. Plus, anti-vax protesters took to the streets across Europe this weekend as coronavirus rates surge and further lockdowns loom. We'll get the latest from our Zurich studio. We'll flick through the papers, get the latest business news, and...
the most important subject for us is to create a channel that talk for the Portuguese audiences. So in our daily basis, we will have the issues, the pundits, the anchors that are really connected with the Portuguese audiences.
And we'll hear about CNN's latest bureau opening in Portugal. That's all ahead here on The Globalist, live from London. First, a look at what else is happening in the news. Chinese President Xi Jinping has said Beijing would not bully its smaller regional neighbours amid rising tensions over the South China Sea. Politicians in Germany are discussing a plan to make COVID-19 vaccinations mandatory for citizens amid soaring infections. And Venezuela's Electoral Council has awarded the country's ruling Socialist Party victory in 20 governorships following local and regional elections. Do stay tuned to Monocle 24 throughout the day for more on those stories. But first, China is coming under increasing pressure as concern mounts for the safety of top-ranked tennis player Peng Shui. She disappeared after accusing a former top official of sexually abusing her. Peng is a women's doubles player who won titles at Wimbledon in 2013 and the French Open in 2014. She's also participated in three Olympics. Well, Beijing is set to host the Winter Games in February, but there are now growing calls for a boycott of those games. Well, I'm joined down the line by Isabel Hilton, who's the founder of China Dialogue. Good morning to you, Isabel.
Good morning, Kevin.
Isabel, this weekend, footage appeared of Peng Shui, mostly from official Chinese government sources, although we've also seen her talking to the IOC. So is she, in fact, still missing? What do we know so far?
Well, what we know has been very carefully curated by the parties. So the videos of her appearing, with the exception of the IOC, have been published by Hu Shijin, who is the editor of the fiercely party-loyal nationalist newspaper Global Times. And in none of those, in none of the Chinese videos, do we hear Peng Shui talking or responding to questions. The IOC video, which I think the Chinese authorities must have regarded as a bit of a trump card, hasn't really had the effect that they want, partly because the IOC is noted for its tendency to comply with regimes, particularly when something as big as the Winter Olympics is coming up. So it doesn't quite have the credibility. What it shows, she's not missing, but it doesn't show that she's not being coerced.
Mm. I mean, this is not the first time a prominent Chinese person's disappeared or suffered some kind of fate like that. The actor Fan Bingbing, the businessman Jack Ma, several others have also suffered a similar fate. Is the modus operandi of Beijing generally the same?
Yes, although these cases, had different causes. The record for disappearance from public view is actually held by a former prime minister, Zhao Ziyang, who disappeared after 1989, after his sympathetic statement in favor of the students who were occupying Tiananmen Square. He disappeared for 17 years. that only ended when his death was announced. So essentially, when somebody crosses the party, they do tend to disappear from public view. Now, they can be party officials because they're being investigated for corruption, and they disappear into a party-run kind of investigation system. They can be outright civilian enemies of the party, if you like protesters, or indeed feminists who vanish. The journalists, for example, who did a lot of the earlier reporting of the COVID outbreak in Wuhan, they've also vanished from public view. Now, some of them are simply scrubbed from the internet. Jiang Bingbing is not in. Pay a very large fine for alleged tax evasion. Others have simply been scrubbed because they have too much influence and the party doesn't want them to exert it. So the circumstances vary. In this case, in Peng Shuai's case, an accusation of this nature against a previously undisgraced former member of the Standing Committee, the Politburo, is a massive embarrassment for the party. They often themselves release data on sexual misconduct by figures who have already been disgraced by the party. But if your party hasn't moved first, then it's a very dangerous game. And the kind of coercion that can be applied, and probably is in Peng Shuai's case, are threats against the family, threats against friends, threats against the person, him or herself, in order to bring them back into line. Peng Shuai is not, in other respects, considered a criminal. She's extremely famous. She's very popular, previously praised. So it's an awkward situation for them.
Now, the Women's Tennis Association says that call with the IOC doesn't alleviate their concerns about her well-being. And there's now a talk of boycott of the Winter Olympics. I wonder, just in a wider context, how important sport is to China's soft power arsenal?
It's been massively important in recent years. I mean, again, this is something that emerged in modern times, but the Summer Olympics, which Beijing hosted in 2008, was a huge boost to party popularity. And it was regarded as a kind of, semi-religious moment. I remember when the televised images of China receiving the torch, it was as though China had suddenly adopted an ancient Greek religion and we were all suddenly expected to have faith in it. It was that important. And there were endless problems in the run-up to that Olympics, including an uprising in Tibet and an earthquake. So it wasn't untroubled. There was a bit of a meme on the Chinese internet about the five mascots being five curses of the Olympic Games. So it became a place where, it was a proxy debate about Chinese politics within China. And this is much the same. If you look now in 2021, issues of lifestyle, issues of sexuality, issues of feminism are live questions as the party is trying to reimpose a kind of Puritan discipline on Chinese society. So it is controversial, of course, globally, because Peng Shuai is a tennis megastar. It's controversial domestically, and there is no easy way of dealing with it for the party. I'm not sure that there will be a sporting boycott of the Winter Olympics, but a diplomatic boycott seems increasingly likely. Mm. And so these efforts can backfire.
And I mean, it's not just the Women's Tennis Association talking about a boycott. I understand that there are now discussions going on between the Five Eyes Alliance about participation in the Games. And I just wonder how that wider boycott would impact on China.
Well, it would be very embarrassing for China, but China would play it as yet another example of Western powers seeking to impede China's rightful return to a central position in global affairs. That is the nationalist narrative which is used to address any kind of dispute between China and Western democracies, and that would be deployed very heavily. So the Winter Games would be another occasion for intensive patriotism in China.
And how might this fit into the broader context of frosty US-China relations?
Well, it would fit in quite well in that what the Chinese government, the party, has been doing is to provide, if you like, proof of life videos for Peng Shuai, which only remind people that proof of life videos are only necessary in a hostage situation. Mm-hmm. And so, it's the interpretation of those videos, which, of course, the party would say, you know, she wants to be left alone, stop trying to instrumentalize, you know, this situation. And the United States would say this only confirms our gravest fears about China as an authoritarian, as an oppressive power. I can't see that it's in either side's interest to ease up on that, frankly. So it is, if it were to escalate into a boycott of the Olympics, it would become a very serious standoff indeed.
Isabel, thank you very much indeed. That is Isabel Hilton there. For over a year now, farmers in India have been protesting about new agricultural laws introduced last September, which they say disadvantage small players in the sector. Now, in a surprise move, the Prime Minister, Narendra Modi, has announced the laws will be repealed. Dr. Shruti Kapila is the Director of Studies in History at Corpus Christi College, University of Cambridge, and joins me now. Shruti, what was in the new laws that so upset the farmers?
Hi. Yes, I mean, there were three laws, and the emphasis was really to take away the role of local and small intermediaries. They're special markets in India called mandis, where prices are, as it were, fixed on wheat and other agrarian produce. But the other was that it was going to free up and really corporatize for big capital to come into the agrarian sector, say, much like the way you have in America, where, you know, vast swathes of the countryside could be owned by a company. Now, this is really what triggered these protests. So these are protests primarily coming from those areas of India's agrarian heartland, which saw, as it were, commercial growth in the last 40, 50 years. So these are not the most impoverished of farmers, but those who have been at the cutting edge of making India sort of food secure in the last 40, 50 years.
Mm. So take us through their fight to have them repealed.
Well, it's really quite remarkable, given that if you pedal back and if your listeners would remember that only last December, I mean, before the pandemic, so 2019 December, India witnessed a kind of a winter protest against the introduction of a discriminatory law on citizenship. Again, you know, city squares were captured and the like, but the pandemic kind of put an end to it because of obviously social distancing and the like. And these farmers, on the other hand, did not do that. They kind of occupied, to use the word, main arteries linking the city of Delhi and the northern agrarian hinterland of Punjab, and they set up camps there. So initially it became quite difficult to drive through. It had to kind of, the motorways had to be rejigged. But then they moved to a site. But despite the pandemic, in true Gandhian fashion, you know, like a Gandhi kind of mobilization, they have been at their camps mobilizing and living there for over a year. And so, yeah, so it's been a very phenomenal non-violent protest, despite provocation to violence and even state oppression.
And why has the Prime Minister acceded to their demands? I mean, is that surprising, and why did he do it?
Yes, it's incredibly surprising. And Indian newspapers today and the weekend are kind of divided. And you could say, because he is not given to humility and he has apologized. He has kind of, you know, really literally eaten humble pie in a broadcast. So you could say there are a couple of triggers. One is really big local provincial elections, which are of very high value to Indian political life, are on the anvil in the coming, and there are regional elections, and where this protest could have a very big impact on the Prime Minister's ruling party and the impact so one is a kind of literally electoral calculus. The other is that actually probably the Prime Minister is realizing that he himself is becoming unpopular as a result of these laws. And three, I think trying to sectionalize it either in terms of that, well, this is only pertaining to the Sikhs, you know, to ethnicizers, to divide it, as it were, the movement also fell short. And above all, there is some special status that Punjab occupies in Indian political imagination. So I think a slew of these reasons have ensured, but it's a real massive loss of face and political capital for Modi.
Mm. How important are the elections in Uttar Pradesh, which, I mean, may be feeding into this too?
Yes, that's right. That's what I meant. Uttar Pradesh, and this is the largest province of India. It goes into election in the winter. It's the size of Brazil, slightly bigger than Brazil. And so it's the biggest state, most consequential state. But equally Punjab, which is not so consequential in terms of the number of MPs or local representation, but very significant. Punjab is not where the BJP is in power, but would like to make inroads. But in UP, it has a full sway. And UP is also the hotbed of polarized Hindu and Muslim political discourse. And so this, in a way, I think the identity politics is going to have been pushed so hard. And coupled with the farmers' protests, which refers to kind of farmers on Western Uttar Pradesh, meant that Modi felt perhaps that he can't take this risk of sort of hardballing the movement any further.
And of course, because there's a general election in 2024.
Yeah, I mean, you could say this is Modi's 7-year itch. You know, he's been there since 2014, and you know, he's had a couple of pretty disastrous moments, demonetization in the first regime, when he, you know, withdrew currency overnight. And then, of course, COVID, which is not really, you know, it has been very, very difficult, challenging, horrific for India. And he seemed to have ridden that through and never really apologized for the prime minister to come on national airwaves and, you know, seek the apology of farmers. I mean, it's a remarkable moment also for the image of Modi for beyond, as it were, the northern heartlands, where probably the eye is on.
Mm. I just wonder, before we go, Shruti, what this means for the future of agriculture, because these laws were based on a very archaic system. Repealing them leaves all sorts of complex systems of subsidies and so on unresolved. It possibly sets back any hope of modernising agricultural and food processing, and means that there isn't a way to move forward, possibly in a more environmentally friendly way of farming.
Well, I think it's very important to raise that what was the content of these reforms. I suppose the kind of economic argument or even the beneficial argument never really got any capital, precisely because despite having majority, the prime minister rushed these laws as fiats. They were not deliberated. They were just passed as ordinances, just declared from the massive high tops of power. Mm-hmm. You can't have such massive reform which concerns 60% of your population without deliberation consultation. After all, 50 years ago, when the Green Revolution happened, years of local, you know, consensus was built up before that went in. Now, none of those processes preceded any of this. And these farmers are, hardened political actors. So they held their nerve. They're still holding their nerve. They're saying we're not going to decamp till they're actually, you know, you give us in writing and that the law is repealed. So I think it's a telling moment also for India's federalism. The economic story, you're quite right. How do you kind of now go about producing new legislation? And I think it's an instruction that you can't just roughshod over things. You need to bring people in, whether it's in environmentalism, climate change, agriculture or land acquisition. All these things have, you know, stuck in a gridlock in India precisely because the answer can't be brute power.
Shruti, thank you very much indeed. That's Shruti Kapila there. Now, still to come on the programme, Austria is in lockdown as the pandemic resurges in Europe, and America is in shock at the Kyle Rittenhouse verdict.
If I had shot two people on the street, wounded a third, I would not have a trial. I think I'd be dead.
We'd be talking to an alderman from Kenosha in just a moment. This is The Globalist. Stay tuned.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
The United States stood divided this weekend after a not guilty verdict was returned on Friday in the case of Kyle Rittenhouse. Rittenhouse had been charged with homicide for shooting and killing two people and wounding a third during anti-racism protests that erupted last year in the city of Kenosha, Wisconsin, over the death of a black man, Jacob Blake. Rittenhouse had armed himself and travelled from out of state to join the protests and protect property. He claimed self-defence in the deadly shooting that ensued. Well, for reaction to the verdict, Monocle's news editor Chris Chermak spoke earlier to Anthony Kennedy, an alderman for the 10th District of Kenosha in Wisconsin. Chris began by asking him about what the year has been like in Kenosha in the run-up to the Rittenhouse trial.
In this past year, we've done a lot of work in Kenosha to build capacity into the system to try to see what some of the underlying problems are and seeing if we can put some structures in place to start to address those. One of the things I've been saying repeatedly is this trial, whatever the outcome was going to be, really wasn't going to help us towards those goals. And so for that, I just was not invested in it. It is a shame that someone comes to our town with the intent to defend property and use lethal force in that mission that they were given or they were assumed. You got to understand, these weren't people coming to your house agitating or terrorizing you at your house, and thus it's a defense of your family. This is someone who traveled across state lines to come to a very volatile situation. Remember, we had a curfew in place, so he violated a curfew. 17 years old, not allowed to carry the weapon that he's carried. And after committing the actions that he committed, carried that weapon back across state lines to Antioch, Illinois. When I take all of that in, it's just hard to accept the verdict as it was put across. I'd love to tell you that I was surprised, but that's just not the truth. I'm disappointed, but I wasn't surprised.
Anthony, you say that you're not really surprised by the verdict. Are you surprised that there wasn't a more severe reaction to the verdict this weekend, that we didn't see a repeat of violence in Kenosha? Was that surprising?
Again, what you're seeing is the work that's been done with a lot of organizations. And I'm not touting the city or the police, even though they've been part of this puzzle. But more pieces of that puzzle really belong to the community activist group. And there are people in this community who have been working tirelessly since the Jacob Blake shooting to, again, build capacity, to try to give voice and outlets where there were no voices and outlets before. Really multifaceted and multi-level. And they're out here trying to do violence interruption at its inception. You know, with the idea is if we can intercede, then we don't need the police in the neighborhoods. We don't need them for these minor things, right? And there's been some success. While I am disappointed in what happened, I'm still a man of faith. There's still hope in the box, right? There's still hope. And in that hope, what I've seen in this last 48 hours is a reiteration of some of that hope, or a reaffirmation of some of that hope, I should say. Like I told you, that verdict, one way or the other, wasn't going to fix anything in our community.
Well, one thing I'm getting from some of what you're saying, Anthony, is that if there is a silver lining to this, it is that Kenosha has already, over the last year ahead of this verdict, started to heal, started to put things in place that can start the healing process for the city. I mean, is that right?
Starting the process is a very, very good phrase. Very similar to treating the wound, right? First, you have to realize there's a wound. First, you have to clean out that wound. I think we're still in that very early stages. We always thought this was a special place. I haven't been disavowed of that, but I will tell you this. As a result of the tragic incidents involving Jacob Blake, it's made me realize that, and others, I would say also in this community, that we can't have a monolithic view of this city. You know, there's parts of this city where people are living very well and they've made decisions that got them there, and God bless them for that. But there's other parts of this city where people are hurting. There's other parts in this city where there's some serious problems. And the Rittenhouse verdict, again, either way, wasn't going to solve those. There's still people who are victims of domestic violence and are losing their lives to domestic violence. We've had a few of those incidences just in the last couple of months. There are still children in this community who are undereducated and malnourished, and we still have to work towards that. There's still people in this community who are living in substandard housing and paying a premium price for that. There are some serious problems that we need to continue to address. And there's serious people who are starting to ask some very serious questions. The distractions surrounded by this trial, those people are not the ones trying to fix this problem. Those groups, those people I've mentioned, they didn't come together for the Kyle Rittenhouse trial. They were here on the ground working beforehand. They're going to be here working afterwards. And that's what's important. Now, the thing that I have concern about is, if you believe in this good guy with a gun narrative, then you've been justified in that worldview with this verdict. And that's the piece that I'm very, very concerned about. You have a former alderperson who called for the militia to come here or called for the protection. He has been stated that publicly on Russian TV and on all kinds of news outlets. That person's going to be emboldened by this verdict.
Well, given the last part of what you said there, people are looking, of course, from across America at this verdict, and particularly that aspect that you mentioned, this idea of somebody crossing state lines armed to join a protest. As an alderman yourself, what can cities do or draw from that in order to make sure something like this does not happen again, or to protect themselves from people who are going to be encouraged to take these kinds of actions?
I don't have an answer for that, man. I wish I did. It's something I continue to pray on. We just tried to have an ordinance last year. One of our newly appointed alderpersons, Shana Griffin, sponsored an ordinance where if you left your weapon in a car and that car was unlocked and your left weapon was stolen, then that would be a city ordinance violation. We couldn't even pass that, man. We couldn't even pass that because of state laws and how much there is around gun ownership. And when you start talking about gun ownership here in the United States, they're saying there's an infringement on your Second Amendment right. And we can't have a conversation just about responsible gun ownership. While my fantasy might be a gun-free society, I'm well aware that that's not reality. I'm a United States Army veteran. I spent 4 years in the defense of this country. I'm not anti-gun, but we have to start having discussions about responsible gun ownership. And if we all talk about what happened in Kenosha and the destruction and the all subsequent unrest, what happened in the end? Was a black man killed by the police? No. A 17-year-old out-of-state teenager came and killed two people and wounded a third in our town. That's the crux of this. And the alt-right here and the Second Amendment supporters, they're going to keep talking to you about how he was attacked. The attack was with a plastic freaking bag, man. If your ego is such that you are attacked with a plastic bag, maybe you shouldn't be out there. I got plenty of friends in this town who are minorities who carry, right? And we say carry meaning they have weapons, for those who don't understand American culture, right? But a lot of my minority friends will not open carry. They're not afforded the same opportunity to open carry as white people and those people that night who responded as such. We're not afforded that. If I had shot two people on the street, wounded a third, I would not have a trial. I think I'd be dead, because that white gun fetish idea of the end is here and I'm the only one standing between anarchy and the rule of law, et cetera, I'm the thing that they were waiting for. Violent black man shooting people, right? I'd be shot as a response. And if we don't understand that, we will never, ever bridge this discussion in reference to responsible gun ownership versus irresponsible gun ownership.
That was Anthony Kennedy there in conversation with Chris Chermak. Here's what else we're keeping an eye on today. Chinese President Xi Jinping has said Beijing would not bully its smaller regional neighbours amid rising tension over the South China Sea. Xi was speaking as part of the ASEAN summit China is hosting. His comments come after Philippine President Rodrigo Duterte condemned attacks by the Chinese Coast Guard on Philippines vessels last week, something the United States has called dangerous, provocative and unjustified. Politicians in Germany are discussing a plan to make COVID-19 vaccinations mandatory for citizens amid soaring infections. Several members of Chancellor Angela Merkel's Conservative bloc said over the weekend that federal and state government should introduce compulsory vaccinations in an effort to push up Germany's low inoculation rate of just 68%. And Venezuela's Electoral Council has awarded the country's ruling Socialist Party victory in 20 governorships following local and regional elections. Only three opposition politicians were victorious in a setback to the opposition after boycotting elections in 2018 and 2020. The country's leftist president, Nicolas Maduro, said the victory was impressive despite a reported turnout of just 41%. This is The Globalist. Stay tuned. Austria goes into a full lockdown today as the country tries to bring down record numbers of coronavirus infections. But before the Christmas markets could pack up and the shops pull down their shutters, tens of thousands of people took to the streets of Vienna to protest not only at the lockdown, but also the introduction of compulsory COVID vaccinations from next February. Meanwhile, across the border in Switzerland, questions are being asked about if, or when, something similar is on the way. Monocle's Emma Nelson joins us now from our studio in Zurich. And Emma, this is a real pleasure for both of us, I think, because as both presenting this programme, we never actually get to speak to each other.
They never let us in the same room together, Georgina, and I'm still in Zurich. So, but we've managed to clamber our way onto the airwaves this morning. It's delightful. A very good morning to you from a very damp and grey and cold, chilly Zurich.
Well, tell us, bring us up to date with what's happening in Austria.
Well, we're just talking about a full lockdown, proper stay-at-home orders, except for basic reasons like exercise and food shopping, back to where we were in March last year. It's expected to last about 20 days, but it will be reevaluated in about 10. And if we think about it, it's only been a week since a partial lockdown was imposed for the 2.5 million or so unvaccinated Austrians. But the infection rates are still shooting up in Austria. So the Austrian government decided to take action. And when I mean the numbers are going up, it's astonishing. Let's take Salzburg, for example. They're running at 3,166 cases per 100,000 people. If you compare that with here in Zurich, where you've just got over 560 cases, or in London, 552, you can really see the size of the problem that they've got on their hands. And with that comes a huge jump in the number of deaths and also a number of people being pushed into intensive care. So we have everybody going to the Christmas markets, doing that last minute lockdown thing over the weekend. Lots of people going to the markets, going to cafes. But we also had this huge protest in Vienna where we had 40,000 people, many leaders from the far right and from the Freedom Party and anti-vaccine parties, all having one last sort of shout at everybody.
And that's not the only place in which it's happening. Tell us the situation in Switzerland.
Well, what's happening is, like Austria, Switzerland has one of the lowest vaccination rates in Western Europe. It's only 65.4%. And what, it's about an hour and a bit's drive from where I'm standing right now to get to Switzerland. So you see just how close this is going. I mean, if you compare the vaccination rates here in Switzerland and Austria, 65-64%, look at Portugal, their numbers are 84%. Totally different approach to vaccines here. So the papers this weekend were full of warnings that a third booster jab wasn't going to be around until next year. But the general consensus is that possibly a lockdown is untenable here in Switzerland. Most white-collar workers are vaccinated. There will be a very, very tough debate to be had whether a full-scale lockdown would be accepted if it is seen as punishing everybody who has been vaccinated for the actions of the minority. At the moment, it's measured that the Austrian rate sort of moves over to Switzerland in about two and a half weeks' time. But there's an added political element which is making this all rather complicated as well.
And that is?
There's a referendum this weekend.
Of course there is.
There's always a good... This one's a very, very important one. It's the only country, I think, which is consulting its citizens on whether to create a legal basis for all the measures that have been in place since the pandemic. And it's a toss-up as to whether it's going to be successful, but it's thought that the measures were going to go through. It causes a real headache for the government, because if you start to impose new restrictions a week or so before a referendum, what you end up doing is you start to create a political climate which could affect the outcome of that referendum. So it's being suggested that were Switzerland to act, it wouldn't be this week, it would be after the referendum had gone through, the measures had been accepted by the Swiss people, and then they could do something about it. But as you and I both know so well, COVID-19 has never really been known to respect the electoral process at any point in time in all this.
Emma, thank you very much indeed. That's Emma Nelson in Zurich. Let's continue with today's newspapers. And joining me in the studio is the writer and broadcaster Yasmin Abdel-Magid. Thank you so much for coming in. It's so lovely to see your face right there.
Thank you. Great to be in the studio.
Now, I can see that the first story you want to talk about is Sudan and the fact that the Sudanese Prime Minister has been released. But I also know, of course, that there's been a huge internet blackout. That's over.
Yes. So last Friday, the internet at least partially came back, has been partially restored, which has been an enormous relief, I think, for the Sudanese diaspora around the world, but obviously also people on the ground, because they could finally come back online, communicate with each other, and let us know what has been happening. But of course, things have escalated over the weekend. There were a number of different protests. And then on Sunday, the Prime Minister signed a 14-point deal on television with the military. And this has been hailed as a sort of, you know, a success. And the Prime Minister Hamdok has said, you know, sources say that he agreed to the deal to stop the bloodshed, because there's been, I think, almost at the last count, 41 people have been shot over the last 3 weeks or so since the coup on October 25th. However, the people on the streets have not actually accepted this deal. In fact, a lot of people, the chants on the streets now are that the revolution has been betrayed by Hamdok by agreeing to this deal with the military. And so, you know, The Guardian has reported, as a number of people have reported, that this leaves the country facing serious political uncertainty, because it's unclear where things are going to go from here.
And what's your personal feeling? Because I know, of course, you have big connections to the country.
Yes, I think it's quite difficult. Firstly, just from a personal point of view, it was great to hear from all my family on the ground and to sort of hear what life has been like since the internet came back. Although I should say it isn't fully back. It still requires VPNs for people to access social media and so on. So there is still a push for the internet to be fully restored. However, I think that there's a level of exhaustion as well as a refusal to accept whatever the military wants. And I think that's really the sense, is that, you know, there is no going back. That is what the real mantra on the streets are, the real push from anyone I've spoken to. They've said, look, Hamdok, the prime minister, the civilian prime minister, he's agreed to a deal with the military. We're not going to accept that. And so there was a millions march yesterday, and there's another one planned for next week. So from my understanding, despite the international community really celebrating this as a move forward, I'm not sure that the streets see it as such.
Yeah, yeah. Let's turn to this story in the FT, which actually has a picture of a good friend of Monocle. She is Rose Cole. She's the general manager of Daunt Books in Marylebone, of course, just round the corner in a bookshop we work with often. And warning of an absolute dire crisis in global supply chains, which means that there won't be the books.
There won't be the books. And I'm sure many of us who have, you know, tried to order things over the last couple of years during the pandemic are aware of the fact that there have been challenges with supply chains across the board. But there's a real issue at the moment with books. And, you know, this report has essentially, this piece in the FT essentially talks about how, you know, from things like paper being more expensive to 20 or 30% more expensive, energy being more expensive, glue and plastic being more expensive, it essentially means that your basic book, which usually takes about a week to print, is taking about 3 weeks to print. In the UK, where there isn't, you can't really print color, full color books, you're essentially looking at, you know, a 12-month from sort of sending your manuscript into actually getting it printed out. And so what we're looking at, I mean, the one of the quotes is that it used to take us a day and a half to get our books into Ireland. Now it's taking us between 6 and 10 days. So not only from the printing is it taking so long, but even delivery. Delivery as well, from Hong Kong, for example, have doubled from the usual 5 to 6 weeks to now 10 to 12 weeks. And so we're really, if the long shot is, or the upshot is, if you want books for Christmas, you've got to be ordering them now, because, you know, even if a book is doing really, really well, you might not actually be able to get it in the bookstore.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, of course, some people would say, well, why don't you just read it online? But of course, that digitization of books is one of the reasons there is this problem, because the paper industry has gone into decline simply because of that fact.
Exactly. And so you actually had a loss of the capacity over the last few years. And of course, anyone knows you can't really give somebody a digital copy of a book for Christmas as well. You know, unwrapping a digital copy of a book is not quite the same thing.
Absolutely not. Let's go to Myanmar. It's not good news.
No. And what the reason I wanted to talk about Myanmar is because obviously having a close connection to the Sudanese context, I think there's actually quite a lot of there are a number of parallels between what's going on in Myanmar and what's going on in Sudan, in particular the civil disobedience movement. And so this piece on the front page of the New York Times headlines "Changing Sides in Myanmar, Notorious Military Regime Has Trouble Recruiting and Some Soldiers Are Defecting," actually talks about how the civil disobedience movement, which has been sort of stealthily online trying to get soldiers and some officers to defect from the military, has actually started to be quite successful. For the first time in its 67-year history, the Myanmar Defence Services Academy was not able to fill the seats for this year's freshman class. And so you're starting to see that folks who have joined the military, maybe because they thought they would be defending their country, maybe because they thought, you know, it would be good food and they would be paid well and so on, are starting to say things like, oh, I didn't realize that I would be shooting my own people and so on, rather than protecting my country. And so over 2,000 people have defected and joined this the civil disobedience movement. And the tactics are also quite interesting. They're literally creating Facebook profiles and sort of messaging people and saying, you know, you're hurting innocent people, and almost, you know, playing on the heartstrings and so on. And I think it's just a fascinating way for some of people, often many of these are in the diaspora, to be able to contribute to the fight that's happening on the ground in a slightly different way to how we've seen in the past.
Yeah. Talking of playing on the heartstrings, well, of course, the master, the queen of that is Adele. And she has done this extraordinary thing. It's a great blow for freedom, I think, for musicians everywhere. Because, of course, musicians create an album for a reason, and there's a narrative arc in it. But Spotify's shuffle button screws all that up, and she said no more.
Exactly. Adele has petitioned Spotify to get rid of the shuffle button on her album, because albums, as you say, are like a story. You know, every song is a chapter, and they should be listened to a particular way. And Spotify replied on Twitter and said, anything for you. And they've actually removed the power, right? Yeah. They've removed the shuffle button from the album pages, so you can still access it, but it's a lot more difficult. And I think it's a hilarious, it's funny. I was listening to this album yesterday and noticed that there was no shuffle button. So yeah, that's the power of Adele.
And did you find that there was a wonderful narrative arc? Did you get?
You know,
taken
I was
on
weeping too much.
Journey.
You know. No, there's definitely a journey. I do think it's quite a fascinating, you know, as somebody who didn't grow up necessarily thinking about music in the same, in sort of like a story or an album way, it definitely, you know, a kid of the shuffle and of the mixtape and so on. It's very interesting to think about what does it mean to listen to an album as like a single piece of work, reading it chapter to chapter in the same way you might read a book.
Yeah.
And how different does that experience become? And so I think perhaps she's, I think actually this is introducing a new way of listening for a generation who maybe didn't grow up listening to physical CDs.
Absolutely. It might be the only way you get to read a book this Christmas. Yasmin, thank you very much indeed. That is Yasmin Abdul-Magied, and this is The Globalist.
UBS is a global financial services firm with over 150 years of heritage. Built on the unique dedication of our people, we bring fresh thinking and perspective to our work. We know that it takes a marriage of intelligence and heart to create lasting value for our clients. It's about having the right ideas, of course, but also about having one of the most accomplished systems and an unrivaled network of global experts. That's why at UBS, we pride ourselves on thinking smarter to make a real difference. Tune in to The Bulletin with UBS every week for the latest insights and opinions from UBS all around the world.
It's time to talk business now with Nabila Ahmed, who is Asia finance reporter for Bloomberg News. Nabila, welcome back to The Globalist. What's going on with Boeing? People seem to be very unhappy with the distribution of the 787.
Good morning, Georgina. Yes, it's not a very good start to the week for Boeing. So they've got more than 100 of their Dreamliners that are stuck, which is tying up inventory worth about $20 billion. And Dreamliners, as you know, are Boeing's flagship wide-body jets, and they're often used on long-haul flights. And as international borders start to open, people are wanting their orders, and it's already affecting some travel schedule. So American Airlines, for example, has already said that it had to trim its flying plans due to the delayed arrival of these 787s. And that's causing quite a lot of consternation among Boeing's customers, who are very, very upset.
But do we know why this is? Because they keep pushing it back. In July, they said August said September. I mean, it keeps on happening. Mañana, as the chairman and the co-founder of a Los Angeles-based air company says.
Yes, I love that quote. Look, Boeing further slowed the production as it's trying to address defects that are delaying the deliveries of the new jets, and it's complicating their plans. As you'll remember from 2018, they had that big crash that was related to their 737 MAX jets, and then there was another one 5 months later. These two claimed 346 lives. Boeing has been under a lot of scrutiny ever since then, and the Federal Aviation Administration in the U.S. launched a broad review of the Dreamliner production in late 2020. So since then, you haven't really seen supplies just come online as per usual. They've largely been halted. And Boeing saying that they really want to make sure that the planes are safe and they're still working on this. There's issues to do with their door. There's like little gaps in where different parts of the airline connect up, and there's some issues in there, and there's problems related to the passenger and cargo doors on aircraft that are already under production. So that's pushing back the timeline.
Mm. Let's have a look at global IPOs, because it's been an incredible year.
It has been an absolute blockbuster year. Global IPOs have smashed their previous record. We've still got another 6 weeks to go this year, but companies globally have already raised $600 billion in IPOs. And there were almost 3,000 companies that joined together to raise this money together. And, you know, this compares with the previous record set in 2007, when it was just over $400 billion. So that record has been surpassed by 50%. What is interesting, though, is that investors are starting to just cotton on a little bit more to the financials of some of these companies. Look, some of the bigger high-profile IPOs this year, including that car company Rivian, for example, doesn't even make any money. Rivian has no real revenue, and they listed very recently at a massive valuation. So I think investors are starting to look, though, deeper into some of the financials of these companies. And when you look at how the IPOs have gone this year, The IPO crops of 2021 in the US and Europe are now on average underperforming their regional equity benchmarks. So there is certainly a warning sign for investors there.
To China now, and we're looking at the property moguls. They're using billions of their own cash on rescues.
Isn't it so funny? Because you wouldn't see that happening in the Western world, because the companies there and their founders are protected by this concept of limited liability. But in China, billionaire owners of Chinese developers have been encouraged to dip into their own fortunes to help out the companies. And a lot of this was driven by the Evergrande saga, as you'll recall, which is one of China's biggest developers, has hundreds of millions of billions of dollars in debt. And you saw the founder there jumping in with $1 billion of his own money to help out the company. And what founders are doing is that they're selling some of their luxury assets, or they're selling some stakes that they have in other listed companies, and just using their personal money to bail out or try to at least help out their troubled businesses.
Mm. And finally, Nabila, a very quick look at Credit Suisse and the US and tax.
Look, Credit Suisse has been in a world of trouble this year. They've been mired in all sorts of issues, from Greensill to Supply Finance to Archegos. They lost so much money in both of those scenarios. And they've been in this long-running court case where what's being investigated is whether they allowed their clients to evade taxes in the US. And what the latest development is that some of Credit Suisse bankers, former bankers, have come out and told criminal investigators that the bank is actually still doing this. They are still helping US clients hide money from the IRS, even after Credit Suisse was forced to pay $2.5 billion in penalties and promised to stop the practice.
Nabila, thank you very much indeed. This is The Globalist on Monocle 24. Today marks the launch of CNN Portugal. The news channel is the brand's first foray into the country's media landscape, with an ambitious project, yet another signifier of the growing importance Portugal holds as a European hub. Well, to find out more ahead of the launch, Fernando Augusto Pacheco recently caught up with the man behind it all, CNN's Portugal director, Nuno Santos.
I think that right now Portugal is a vibrant market that has been changed a lot in the last, 5 to 10 years. The news channels are really strong in our market. I would say that are a case study when we look to the landscape in the European situation. And well, I don't want to talk for CNN, but I think that when we start to talk in beginning of this year of 2021, they believe that we have capacity to do, sharing with them, a strong, not only a strong broadcast channel, that's part of the deal, but also a very strong digital operation. And for us, that's also something, I won't say something new, but something very different than the things that we are doing until now.
And it is quite a big launch, right, in terms of numbers, you know, for Portugal. Tell us a bit more about the number of journalists that have been hired for the operation. Tell us a bit about the numbers of CNN Portugal.
Well, probably it's important to explain something that you don't know, or your listeners also doesn't have that information. We belong to a big media group that is the most important media group in Portugal, called Media Capital. Media Capital, well, we have a strong entertainment and drama operation with the FTA channel. Right now, we are not the leaders of the market, but we were during more than 10 years. And we have also in FTA a strong news operation. So we mixed our news operation in FTA with the operation of CNN. That means that's part of the resources we will share between our FTA and our news channel, that is CNN. Well, I'm talking about the production, the planning, things that actually we can share for both brands, I can say it. But we have a team between anchors, executive producers, line producers, of almost 60 people dedicated to the operation of CNN. And of course that we are sharing also all the net that CNN has across the world. And we are talking about a huge operation. Even that's the most important subject for us, it's to create a channel that talk for the Portuguese audiences. So in our daily basis, we will have the issues, the pundits, the anchors that are really connected with the Portuguese audiences.
And Nuno, every time I think of Portugal as well, I have a feeling that the country is becoming almost like a hub in Europe, but also the close connections to Africa, the other Lusophone countries. Would you say that's one of the strengths as well of CNN Portugal? And you even mentioned that you might collaborate with the, you know, the huge network CNN, but I think Portugal is in such a strategic position, actually.
Yes, well, I'm a little bit suspect to talk about that, but I think that we have a very, not only in a geographic perspective, but also because Portugal has a unique position to do that connection between the north and the south, even in the language, because, well, we are a small country, of course, we have 10 million of people, but we can connect with the Africa countries that speak Portuguese, and some are big countries like Angola or Mozambique, with the difficulties that we know, but with the capacity to grow. Then we have the capacity to work with Brazil, and we have also a CNN Brazil. So I believe that not only in other fields for political reasons, strategic reasons, but also in the communication, we have a role that we can put on the table. And I believe that for CNN, that's part of the interest of the Portuguese markets.
Very much so. And Nuno, I mean, you must be a very busy man these days because the network is launching this coming Monday, right? So you must have a crazy weekend ahead.
A crazy week, but at the same time, it's the most stimulant and I would say unforgettable times of our lives. I always said this to the young people that we have on the team. I have this experience. I launched the first news channel in Portugal 20 years ago, and I have it on my front. It's called SIC Noticias. Everyone says 20 years ago, well, it's not possible in a market like Portugal. We don't have enough news. Imagine, we don't have enough news to do a 24 hours news channel. We don't have enough people on the political field, commentators and this and that. But we did it. And I remember that experience for many reasons, but one of the reasons, it's because the process of building the grid to tell the people the right things and the wrong things that we cannot do, but the right things to do, trying, and the world changed completely in 20 years. 20 years ago, we don't have, well, we have it, but it's very different. We don't have internet like we have it today. We don't have social media. Well, it's another reality. So yes, it's a very busy week, and we are in the middle of a political crisis in Portugal. So that means that I would say that we will have at least 3 months is really busy in our front, but it's an amazing time to launch a channel with the brand of CNN. And that makes the difference.
And you can hear that full interview with the CNN Portugal director, Nuno Santos, on The Stack. And that's all we have time for on today's programme. Thanks to our producers, Daniel Bache, Paige Reynolds and Charlie Filmer-Court. Our researchers, Sophie Monaghan-Coombs and Lillian Fawcett. And our studio manager today was Christy Evans. After the headlines, there's more music on the way and Emma will be with you from Zurich for The Briefing at noon London time. I'm Georgina Godwin. I'll return on The Globalist at the same time tomorrow.